We've been going through the book of Esther, and this will be the last one. We're going to finish them up today. Now, last week I spent about 5 minutes going through a recap of everything. I'm not doing that this week. I'm just going to kind of jump right into the story here pretty much. So if you don't know the story of Esther, you're going to have to go online and catch up. Say, what were they talking about? Then you can go online and catch up. So anyway, that's it. But I do just want to kind of say one thing about the book of Esther, though, before we leave it, because this will be it. We're going to finish it today. We've got a lot of room to cover, and so I'm going to go on to it rather quickly. But I just can't get out of this without making one comment, and maybe nobody here is going to care. But this just blew me away. The book of Esther is really beautifully written. And in fact, sometimes the Bible is incredibly beautiful and we don't know. You know, sometimes it's because it's obviously a translated book for us. We don't know if it's native language and we miss a lot of the nuances. But every now and then something comes up. And one thing I love about going into the Old Testament books is that I get a chance to not only read commentary from modern Christian thinkers, but actually get to read commentary from Jewish thinkers. And, there's some rabbis who have been studying this and they have, hand-me-down, stuff from thousands and thousands of years, and it's really kind of neat. And I read this one rabbi's kind of outline of the book of Esther, and he pointed something out that's really pretty incredible, and that is this perfect symmetry to the book of Esther. This has nothing to do with the sermon, but I just have to mention this because this just blew me away. So in the book of Esther, everything comes in pairs. It's like mirror images on both sides, and we come down to this, and the first part of it, this side of it, it's all Persia. Jews are kind of downtrodden, and it's Persia. Then we hit this middle part, and after that, it swings the other way, and everything ends up all Jewish. But each one of these bookends, so it starts out with these two banquets, that Vashti had a banquet, and Xerxes had a banquet. It moves on from there. We see Haman, the evil, the villain of our story. We'll talk about him again today. So Haman, this evil person, but he gets elevated in the kingdom, and then he passes this anti-Jewish edict where he's going to wipe out all of Jerusalem, and again, we'll be dealing with that today. And then there's this first banquet of Esther's, and we're kind of touching that, we'll talk more today. So that kind of ends the downward arc. And then we have this moment we talked about where the king honors Mordecai. And so this, you can tell God just stepped in at that moment and honored Mordecai. And after that, everything swings the other way. But it mirrors it. So we have the second banquet of Esther, which of course mirrors her first. And then we have the pro-Jewish edict, which we'll get to. And then we get the elevation of Mordecai instead of the evil Haman. And then finally it with two banquets of the Jews. So it's this perfect symmetry. And I just like, as a storyteller, I'm just always amazed, when I see things like that. Like, man, God just pulled off a perfect story. But anyway, so that's where we are. We're going to pick this up and we're going to back up just a little tiny bit. This is right after the Jewish edict has gone out where Haman's going to destroy all the Jews on December 13th. In honor of my birthday, they're going to wipe out all the Jews. And so they had that all scheduled and everything was going well and Haman had everything under control. And something happens to all the plans at this point. And we talked about this last week because Esther walks into the throne room and she's not been called, so that could be instant death for her, but she does it anyway because it's just so important. And the king sees her there and he could just say, take her out and kill her. But instead he extends the golden scepter to her. We talked about this last week and after time or a few times anyway, they finally start talking about what she came there for. And so he says, what's troubling you, Queen Esther? What's your request? So why are you here? Why are you worried about something? I can tell something's worrying you. What's your request? Anything you want, up to half of my kingdom, I will give to you. And Esther says this, if it pleases the king, may the king and Haman, your trusted associate, come this day to the banquet that I prepared for him back in my chambers. And I was just kind of, as I was reading through this phrase popped into my head that you probably know because it comes from a very famous psalm, a table before me in the presence of my enemies. It's from Psalm 23, which is known as the shepherd's psalm usually because it starts out talking about the Lord is my shepherd and has all this imagery from being a shepherd. But then it breaks and it goes from this whole thing about the rod and the staff and shepherd. And all of a sudden he says this, you prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. And just in the middle of the psalm, it kind of jarred me, even as a kid, like that doesn't fit with the rest of it. What's he saying here? And I'm thinking, that's a strange place to prepare a table, isn't it? Have you ever been at a dinner with people didn't like you, maybe even hated you, in-laws maybe, or maybe a boss that you knew was trying to get you fired or something, or just, you know, some kind of a conflict, and you're sitting there? Isn't that an uncomfortable place to be? That is just really, really uncomfortable. Christmas parties when you know the boss wants to lay you off or something. I've been there. It's not fun. You're kind of this queasy feeling. You can't eat, you know. So what the psalmist is saying there is, even in this moment, God's there. God is there, and he's preparing a place for me. Even though I'm surrounded by enemies, he's going to provide for me. You know, this is this really beautiful thing. William Cowper wrote a famous hymn. When I grew up, people thought this hymn was in the Bible. The title of it is God Moves in a Mysterious Way. Maybe you've heard that. It's not in the Bible. It's from a hymn. In fact, people used to ask my dad where in the book of the Bible was that from, and my dad used to say from the second book of Hezekiah, which, by the way, is also a book not in the Bible. He had a strange sense of humor, because then people go off to try to find it. That was before Google, and you actually had to open up the book. That was his plan. Get him to look in the Bible. When they figure out Hezekiah is not there, maybe they'll figure out the other one isn't. But it's a really great hymn called God Moves in Mysterious Ways, and this is one of the verses. You fearful saints, fresh courage take. The clouds you so much dread are big with mercy and shall break in blessings on your head. By the way, I love this hymn so much, I literally wrote it in my Bible. So when somebody asked me where it is in my Bible, I'd open up the front page. It's right here. You know, this is where it is. It's a great, great hymn, but it's talking about how God has this stuff planned that we don't understand, but he's got this taken care of. And here we are. Here's Esther. She's, by the way, on the edge of a knife blade here. Because she's Jewish, no one knows it. That secret gets out, it's not good for her, because the Jews have just been sentenced to extermination. So she's really walking a very fine line at this point. And remember, in Persia, the king had absolute control. And he could just send her off and have her killed for nothing, for walking into his room and bothering him. I'm sometimes in a bad mood if my wife walks in and bothers me, but she knows I'm never going to try, you know, banish her or something. Yeah, just try it, right? But anyway, so, you know, that, but it was different then, right? The women had no status at all in the society. So she's walking a very, very fine line, but here she goes, and she says, come to my place, and I'm going to prepare a dinner for you. And so the king loves this idea. Well, bring Haman quickly. Let's go. And so they went and they to the banquet which Esther had prepared. Now, this is the New King James Version, because I just love the way they put this. At the banquet of wine. I thought, banquet of wine? What's that? It sounds like someplace you're going to get drunk, is what it sounds like. The banquet of wine. It's like going to Repepe's. Ever been there? When they have that wine tasting, all these bottles of wine open everywhere. Well, you can drink as much as you want all the way down. I would never make it to the end of that table. You know, like if I just going through the banquet of wine. And so I looked that up. Like, man, what's a banquet of wine? Well, it turns out that this word here that's being used here in Hebrew, in this case, can mean banquet, but it usually means cup. A drink, a specific cup of wine. So there, in other words, there came to a moment in the dinner when they were drinking this special cup of wine, and the king says, what do you want? You know, you called me away. This is great, enjoying the dinner, but you had a purpose for this, Esther. What is it that you want? What's your request? Again, he says, up to half my kingdom I will give you. And Esther now has her final chance. She's got the king here, and there's Haman, and now you would think she's going to slam her trap shut, and she's going to, you know, reveal Haman for the evil, wicked, scheming twerp that he is. And yet what she says is, well, my petition is this. If I found favor, if it pleases the king to do what I request, may the king and Haman come to the banquet which I'll prepare for them tomorrow. And then I will do what the king says. And this has troubled theologians for 3,000 years. Why? God didn't need a sacred banquet. We have all the principles together right now, right here. Why two banquets? And so no one really knows. Of course, we can't know this, but why didn't she just take care of it then? And now we know that instead of that, you know, they go home, and then Haman ends up with that whole thing with Mordecai we talked about last week, that he gets taken down and Mordecai gets exalted. So that happens between the two banquets, but God could have done that any time. Why the two banquets? And I was praying about this, and I know it's arrogant when, you know, you have rabbis and Christian theologians that have been studying this thing for thousands of years. I'm saying, well, God, just tell me, you know, just whisper in my ear. I won't tell anybody but my church. There's only 30 people there. You know, just tell me why. And I actually believe that God told me why, or at least one of the reasons why. I'm not being arrogant. I'm like, God likes me best, so he told me. And it's just, I think this is one of the reasons. Scripture has many layers, and there's many reasons probably why. But he took me back to something that some of us know a little bit about, because we've experienced this together, and that's Passover. And in fact, there are four cups of wine at Passover. Now, those of you who've been to our Seder, you know this, because we've done this now three times. We've gone through this. And if you haven't been to our Seder, you need to come this year. Start making plans. You do not have to be a member of Spirit Chapel to come to it. You simply have to come to Spirit Chapel one time to be invited. But you have to come one time. And so everybody here is invited. And so I want to tell you, by the way, that I believe, and this is maybe I'm going on a limb here, this is going to be our best ever. This year, and I don't say this every year, you guys know this, I don't. This year is going to be our best ever. I think that, you know, we're kind of getting our, the first one was so far the best because it was new to all of us, and it was just, it was at the Hinchy's house, and it was intimate, and there were only 30-some of us there. It was really great. Next year was bigger. We had a lot of people. We're over the fire hall, and then last year we're up at Sunset Room, which was a beautiful venue. But this year it's going to be really something special. I just can feel it coming, and so I hope you can kind of clear your schedule for that. We do it Monday, Thursday in the Easter service time. And so just kind of keep your eye open for that. We'll be talking about more when it gets closer. But the four cups of Passover, let me get back to that for a second. Because what really, when I was just studying this passage, really impressed me was the fact that Esther invites the king to both banquets exactly the same way. Like actually the same words almost. Like literally, like she says it the very same way both times. And it occurred to me that all they're really doing is taking a break in one banquet. So we call it two banquets, but it's actually they're eating, they take a break to go home and sleep, and they come back and kind of continue it. And when I saw that, I thought, oh, okay. So then I just felt like God was saying, go back and look at the four cups of the Passover. Now, there are four times in the Passover dinner that we drink wine. Now, because we're trying very hard not to get drunk, we have one cup of wine we take sips from. And you don't have to drink wine. We have grape juice too. But we have real wine there for those of you who want it. So we're trying to do that. So we just have this, you know, little sip. But in Jewish culture, you actually would fill up your cup and place it in front of you before this part begins. And somebody asked one of the rabbis, why do you do that? And his answer was very interesting. He said, because what happens is the cup is a witness. And the whole purpose of the Passover is to tell the story of God's deliverance of his people. And we're supposed to remember it. That's the purpose of Passover. And so he says, it's there as a witness to all the good that God has done to us, and it consumes it, like takes it in. And then when we drink that down, it's like us embracing all of that, so we will remember it too. It's symbolic of that. So it's this witness to this part. So every cup is actually one part of the story. So they all have names. I don't know if anybody remembers the names. We kind of throw them out. Does anybody know what the name of the first cup of Passover is? Okay, so I clearly need to do a better job teaching Passover when we're there. The first cup is the cup of sanctification. Now, this comes from the verse in Exodus where God says, I will bring you out of Egypt. And it actually has two meanings. One is, of course, they were in bondage in Egypt, so he says, I'm taking you out of the bondage. But there's another problem, and that is they had become a lot Egyptian. They had a lot of Egyptian culture mixed into their culture. They kind of lost their identities as Jews. And so God was saying, I'm going to call you out of Egypt, and I'm going to pull you away from Egypt, both the bondage and also their culture. I'm going to make you mine. This is another word for holy is this. It's separation. I'm going to separate you from what you were into something else. So if you look at what Esther does when she walks into the king of Persia, she says, come away with me. She doesn't have, I'm going to come here and prepare a banquet here, king. She has no husband. You've been locked in this room for 30 days. Drop it now. Come away with me as a husband to a wife. Come away with me to a banquet that I will prepare over my place. So I believe that's why this is like the first cup. It's the cup of sanctification. She's pulling him away. So that was the first cup. What about the second cup? So the second cup comes. They come back in. And again, the very same kind of verbs go on. On the second day, at the very point in the dinner where they have this special cup, this banquet of wine, this special cup. So they come to the second cup of Passover. Anybody want to take a stab? Anybody remember the second cup of Passover is? No? Second cup is the cup of judgment. Okay, so we know what's about to happen here then, don't we? And there's a reason, I believe, why she had these two, because she's ready to bring judgment down on Haman. Now, when we do the Passover, if some of you have been there, there's a weird thing happens on the second cup. Some of you may remember this, because as a leader is kind of taking us through this, he's talking about the 10 plagues of Egypt. And when every plague is mentioned, we take our finger in the cup of wine, we take it out, and we splash it down on our plate. And why is that? You know, and again, they ask this rabbi, why is that? Why do we take our finger and we put it on the plate? Well, the rabbi explained that the plagues of Egypt are curses. And so as we tell the story of the curses, we don't want to drink that later. And so as every curse comes, actually in Jewish culture, they actually pour a little bit of it out. It's like, I don't want that in the wine. They actually pour it out so they don't have it, and then they drink what's left. We drink the blessings, but we ignore the curse. We don't want the judgment. We just want the blessings. Amen. Yeah, that's what I want too. I just want the blessings, not the judgment. So here's Esther, and we're finally getting there. And he says, now what can I do for you? And she is about to bring judgment down. And she says, well, if I found favor in your sight, O king, if it pleases the king, let my life be given to me. Now that must have shocked him. Well, I didn't know that you were going to be killed. What's that about? He says, and my people, please, at my request, if I could save our lives, could I do that? The king is really baffled at this point. She says, we've been sold, my people and I. We've been sold, but we've been sold to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated. Now, this is news to the king, because the king did not know, first of all, he doesn't know she's Jewish. And even if he did, he didn't know that an edict went out to kill the Jews. Haman kind of tricked him on that. He simply said, hey, there's some people in the kingdom that aren't following your laws. I think we should wipe them out. He says, sure, go ahead. He had no idea the scope of what he approved. You know, Haman never told him it was all the Jews, didn't tell him it was in all the places. It just simply said, hey, there's some people who aren't following your laws, we should get rid of them. Yeah, go ahead, get rid of them. He had no idea he was talking about mass extermination of an entire race of people. He didn't know. And so he was probably a little bit baffled at this point. He certainly didn't know his favorite queen in the whole wide world was going to be one of them. You know, and so then I love how Esther plays this. She's really cool here. She goes, look, if it had only been we were sold as slaves, I wouldn't even trouble you. You know, well, I would, by the way. But he said, I wouldn't even bother you for such a small grievance as that. But that's not it. Although she points out that if we were taken away from you as slaves, I don't know how anybody would repay you. But beyond that, but we were scheduled for execution, and that's the problem. The king says, what's this about? Who would dare do such a thing? Who is he? Point him out to me. And that's when the judgment comes. Him. Haman. The wicked Haman. And she's very clear here. He's wicked. He's evil. This is deceitful. This is evil. He did this deliberately. This is just, he made a mistake. He is wicked and he is evil. And you must imagine at this point, poor Haman's face went white, you know. And the king does something interesting. One thing the Bible tells us about King Xerxes is he was not a rash man. And we see this throughout. He never just goes off the handle. He has a temper, clearly, but he controls it. In this case, he rises in anger and goes out in the garden. He's like trying to get his thoughts together. He understands the burden of being a ruler. This, you know, he had extended the Persian Empire, by the way, greater than anybody before him, and there was a reason for that. He wasn't a bad ruler. And so when he could control his emotions, then he was able to think through things, and so he went in the garden to think through things. It's not so easy just killing off a rich man, and Haman was incredibly rich. Because he needs the money of his nobles to go fight the Greeks, which he's been planning for 30 days to go invade, you know, Greece. And so he needs them. He needs the nobles to back him. He needs their money. So he can't just rush back and kill Haman, right? And beyond that, there's this whole thing that an edict from the king cannot be repealed. So now he's really got a conundrum here. Because it went on under his signet. He knows that. And he can't repeal it. But he loves Esther. And he realizes he's been tricked. He's trying to work through it as a diplomat and as a statesman, but Haman has no such desire. He falls on his knees in front of Esther because he sees it. He realizes he has completely underestimated this woman. He thought she was just a dumb beauty queen, but she's not. She's not only smart, she's got a spine of steel. And he suddenly realizes she has set a trap for him. And so he starts to beg her. Now, in those days, they didn't eat in chairs. They lounged in couches. Have you ever seen the pictures of it? I would love to have that. Just lounging around and eating. You know, that's like in a recliner now. When we watch the Steeler game, you sit in a recliner. You're like the old Greeks and Persians. And so they had these couches set up there. And so they were all lounging on the couches when she pointed her finger at him. And he comes to her couch to beg her for his life. And the king comes back right at this moment. And he sees him on his wife's couch. Now, it's one thing for a king to be a diplomat. It's a completely different thing for a jealous husband to be a diplomat, let me tell you. And he sees her there, and he says, oh, are you daring to try and intimidate her with me here? I can't believe what I'm seeing. And as soon as he says that, the eunuchs came up and put a bag over his head. Now, the eunuchs, remember, love Esther. They've always loved her. She's been kind to them and sweet. And so all the eunuchs just love her. Now, eunuchs being who they were and kind of moving around, they knew all the gossip. Because they knew everything that was going on. They couldn't tell the king, because a eunuch can't have an audience with the king. They're a servant. But they know everything going on. And so this eunuch must really, for the first time, realize, boy, Esther has pulled this one off. And so they cover this guy's head, and then the head eunuch says, just in case it would help, king, I happen to notice there's a 50-foot gallows right away from the thing that Haman had previously built to kill Mordecai. And it's just there not being used. Use it, don't use it, just some information I thought I would give you here. And the king says, that's a great idea, hang him on his own gallows. So they go out and do it, and now the king feels better, because there's nothing like getting your anger out than hanging somebody. You know. So the king kills off Haman, and he's feeling better. Okay, that wasn't so bad. That's a good dinner there. You have dinner, kill a wicked man, you know, good day for the king. So he was done, but listen, Esther is just getting started. And this is an amazing change from Esther that we met in chapter 2. There she was scared. She was just a little girl trying to get along by on her looks. She was nice and sweet, but she basically did whatever anybody told her to do. She was just really very pliable, and she kind of embraced everything. She was not one to cause any waves, and so that's how come everybody liked her, because she wasn't a brat. She was really sweet, but that was a different Esther than the one we're about to meet. And coming in from coming in a Christmas time, it reminded me of this moment in a famous Christmas story.
And what happened then? Well, in Whoville, they say that the Grinch's small heart grew 3 sizes that day.
It's almost like we have watched Esther's heart grow 3 sizes in the past chapter. Something really amazing has happened to her, because she's no longer this timid little girl. She is just getting started. Haman's death is just the beginning of the plan. And so from there on, you're going to watch her just move with an assurance and a confidence that no one has ever had in probably the Persian history. She probably moves through the palace right now like no woman has ever moved through the Persian palace. And I'm cutting out some of this, but every time she comes in front of the king's presence, she still follows protocol. She never assumed anything. She always followed protocol. But you can tell behind the protocol, there's an understanding right now between Xerxes and Esther. And I'll tell you what it's like, and you husbands and wives will know what I'm talking about. When the wife will ask a husband a question that's not a question. You guys know what I'm talking about? Yeah. Let me put this down for those of you who maybe don't follow what we're saying here. Victoria will walk in a room, and she'll ask a question like this. Oh, are you wearing that? Okay, now that technically is a question, right? It's a question, it sounds like a question, but that's not a question, is it, guys? Because my answer is usually, no, I was not going to wear this, was going to wear something else, right? Because I know that wasn't a question. And so now we have these moments where we see Esther the same thing. She's walking in here, and you can see Xerxes go, no, because Esther suddenly is now in charge of everything. So on that day, he's going to give the house of the enemy to her. Says, okay, there's a man hanging on your new house, right there, that's yours. By the way, an incredibly wealthy house. And when it's house, it's not just the physical house, it's the house of Haman, right? It is like she now is the head, the matriarch of the entire house of Haman. So he didn't just give her a building, he gave her incredible wealth. Now she was the queen, but this was now hers. He says, you can have the house of Haman. Every servant now becomes her servant. And Haman's wife will now serve Esther. Haman's sons will now serve Esther. She now owns the house of Haman. And so he gives her, and she goes, I would like you to meet somebody that I think you know. And they call for Mordecai to come in. And he was out at the gate being Mordecai, because Mordecai was always working. And they call him in, and now it's the first time she says, you know Mordecai. And the king says, sure, this is the man who saved my life. He's my uncle. And the king is delighted. He did not know that was her uncle, and says, well, this is great news. He takes the signet ring that he yanked off of Haman's hand that was his signet ring, and he gives it to Mordecai and says, you know what? I'm going to put you in charge like Haman was in charge. I need a good second in command. Clearly, you're more worthy than him because you only have my best interests. So you are now going to be second in command. And then Esther gives him House Haman. So now Mordecai's in charge of all of that, and she gives it all away to him. So repay Mordecai's kindness, check, and she's still not done. So got rid of Haman, repaid Mordecai for his kindness, which I think is great. That was her first move, really, in her power move, is to repay the man who took her in when he didn't have to. And so she never forgot that. And so then the next day she comes into the king, same thing, you know. But by now you realize as soon as he sees her, he's just waving that scepter. You know, come on, come on, come on, come on. So she walks in again and she speaks to the king. And she says, look, again, if I have found favor in him, there is a matter that I think might be proper. Why don't we go ahead and revoke that evil law that's getting ready to kill my people? Now, killing Haman was a good move, right? But there's still this law in the books that says the Jews are going to be exterminated on December 13th. That's a problem, Your Highness. So is there some place that we can do that? Because I really don't want to watch. I know I'm safe now, but I don't want the destruction of all of my relatives. I don't want to do that. And Xerxes does something very clever here. He says, you know what? I gave the house of Haman to you. You repeal it. See, it's a tough thing for a king to repeal his own law. He's not supposed to do it. But Haman's seal would have been on that same edict. He would have put his house seal on it, and then he would have put the king's seal on it when it went out. So everybody knew who to report back to with questions. So I'm sending it, but the king's backing me, is how that would have gone out. So he's saying, I really can't repeal it because it went out under my signet, but you can repeal it because now you're in charge of the house. So they simply sent out another edict, and they put the house Haman's seal on it and the king's seal on it, and it went out to everybody and says, okay, let's go ahead, because if you do that, it can't be revoked, which is, you know, funny since they just revoked the last one, but that's how it happens. So this thing goes out to save all the Jews. So basically, we're going to countermand that order. You're not allowed to kill all the Jews on December 13th, but Esther was still not finished because she knows people. And like, oops, I killed him, didn't get the edict, sorry. You know, I didn't hear the pullback. I didn't get the countermand. I'm going to kill the Jews anyway. She knows a lot of people hate the Jews. And so they decided to do something more. They sent it out to everybody, all the commanders, in the name of King Xerxes, with the signet ring. And here's what they say. They say the Jews have the right to assemble and defend themselves. Well, that's a different story now, isn't it? Instead of just attacking the shopkeepers and killing them, you know, blindsiding them, they're not allowed to assemble. They're now allowed to build up their own armies. And in fact, all the princes and all the satraps and all the province leaders gave them Persian armies to protect them. So this is like, if anybody attacks you, you have the right to attack back, and you know, 007, license to kill, you have a license to exterminate. So if anybody dares attack you, you can wipe them out. Not just those people, you can go after their families, you can wipe out their entire houses, and you're allowed to plunder everything they had. Now you would think that at this moment, nobody would ever attack them. And yet, people did. And so they came after him. And on the 12th month of the 13th day, when the king's command and edict were about to be executed, on the day when the enemies of the Jews hoped to gain mastery over them, it was turned to the contrary. So Jews themselves gained mastery over those that hated them. So something remarkable happens. Because boy, if you're going to go attack them anyway, there's a hatred building you for the Jews. You're just waiting for that order, right? You almost don't need it. And so you're still going to pester the Jews. You're going to harass the Jews. You may try to kill them in secret, you know, because you just had it taken away from you. And so instead what happens, we identify those people and we destroy them. So all the enemies of the Jews were destroyed. And in fact, the Bible says people started converting to Judaism after this because they saw that there is something sweeping through the Persian nation and the entire empire where the Jewish people are being exalted. And they said, well, I want a piece of that. Well, what's happened is God's breath was breathing upon the Persian empire, right? And the whole thing is being moved along. Now, because of this, the Jews rid themselves of their enemies. And a month that was turned to them from sorrow to gladness. In fact, it was supposed to be a day of mourning, and instead it became a day of a holiday. They should make themselves a feast and rejoicing, and they actually send portions of the food to the poor. So this is what happens. We go from this place where it should have been weeping and wailing as the entire Jews were wiped out, or mothers crying for lost children, and this horrible thing. Instead, it becomes shouts of joy. Only God can pull this one off, right? This is a whole different level, right? It wasn't just, we're going to take the law away, we're going to get rid of this evil man. God said, I'm going to turn this all the way around. Watch when I'm done with it. This day was supposed to be a day of mourning. It's going to turn into a day of rejoicing. You know, those dark clouds, which you think have curses, they're going to open up and it's going to rain blessings down upon you. So thus the Jews undertook what they had started to do. And therefore they call these days Purim. after the name of Pure. And because of the instructions in the letter, the Jews established and made a custom for themselves and their descendants that they would not fail to celebrate these 2 days. It took them 2 days to kill their enemies. Throughout every generation, these days of Purim were not to fail from among the Jews or from the memory of their descendants forever. By the way, they are still celebrating today. That is a feast that has gone on for 3,000 years. Still celebrate to this day. So now you see the next thing that she did. Remember God's blessing forever. This is just an incredible arc that Esther's been on. You know, I love the stories. I love story arcs and things like that. And so she's just so different from the little girl, that timid little girl that we said. And that's kind of how we started this whole series, right? That, she didn't have the advantage of being blessed like David and anointed with oil. That's great. Or called forth like Jeremiah before you were even born, or had this Damascus Road experience like the Apostle Paul. And that was how this whole thing started. Sometimes we don't have those great grand moments. Sometimes we're just kind of trying to find our way in life. And I had a lot of you tell me when we started a series, that's cool because that's how I feel. I hear about God speaking to people, or I have this big conversion moment. That's never been my story. I'm just kind of trying to make my way the best I can. I'm a little confused at what's going on, and I'm trying to do well, but I don't even know if I'm doing the right thing. So they were kind of interested to see what's going on with Esther. And so now we're at this moment where Esther has turned everything around, and you ask yourself, when did that happen? Boy, I missed it somehow. Somehow, in this whole story of Esther, I missed when she became Queen Esther. When did that happen? And the answer is, it happened about a chapter ago, but it seems so small at the time. But this is the moment where everything changes. I'm going to show it to you because I think we can take something away from this on our own bit. If you're sitting there saying, I'm trying to find my way, I'm trying to figure out how to get through this, I'm trying to figure all this out, watch what happened to Esther. I'm going to show you the moment her life changed around, okay? So here's a kind of timeline. You can watch how it's going, up and down, up and down, up and down, kind of like a lot of our lives, up and down, although some of you are up and then down, 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 up a little bit and down, but this is her, up and down. She starts out as down as you can get. She's a captive. She's a Jew in a conquered nation, right? She's a girl, and in those days, you were chattel. You couldn't own anything. You were owned, in fact, in those days. And she was an orphan. And even in Jewish culture, orphans are really out of luck, right? So just as low as it gets. But then she gets adopted. Mordecai adopts her. Hey, my life's getting better. Oh, but then she gets taken. The soldiers come and grab her because she's pretty. And so they bring her, take her away to the palace. But she's got a sweet personality. She has favor with the eunuch. Yay! But you have to wait in the palace by yourself for over a year. Maybe the king will get around to you. Right? So it's not looking good then. It must have been a very dark year for her. She has to learn all these customs. And maybe she'll never get a chance to see the king. So all this is for nothing. And who knows what's going to happen to her then. And then she gets chosen by the king. And you would think, well, then her life starts up. No, it doesn't. It goes right back down because the next thing that happens is Haman comes to power and he wants to kill her. He doesn't know it, but he's going to kill her too. So that's really bad. And then she has this moment where she gets challenged by Mordecai. And this is the moment of decision for her. When Mordecai says, Esther, how do you know that God didn't bring everything together and brought you here for a moment such as this? And then what does Esther do? She fasts. She says, I'm going to go fast for 3 days and think about what you said. And if God tells me to do it, then I will go ahead and go on. I will, if God, in my fasting, God says, go do this, go see the king, I will go see the king. And in fact, she says, and if the king kills me, then he kills me. Well, that's a pretty remarkable thing for a girl who's just been trying to get along up until now. What in the world happened? Well, I'll tell you what happened. Esther went from being the queen of Persia to being the daughter of the one true king. She said, you know what? I am the queen of Persia, but I don't care. What I want to be is a daughter of Jehovah. Everything changed after she fasted. Do you see that? Everything changes in the whole story of it. Her arc changes completely after she fasts. Why? Why is that so special? We talked about it. Listen, I did a 3-part series on fasting. Some of you know that in July of this year, right in the middle of the In God We Trust series. I'm not going to go through all of that again. But if you haven't heard it or if you forgot it, go back and watch it. because we bring out a lot of points about fasting in that and how to fast right. And I'll just kind of summarize it by saying this, because a lot of people teach fasting wrong. They teach fasting that it's either you're supposed to do it because, you know, you suffer through it because you're a Christian, you're supposed to suffer for your Christian. Some people teach that. And some people say, well, actually, if you fast, it's like your prayers are on steroids. It's like you amp up your prayers to a different level, and God will answer your prayers if you fast. You just got to fast first, and then he will hear your cries, and he'll answer your prayers. Look, the purpose of fasting is not to make God hear your cries. The purpose of fasting is so you can hear God's whisper. So go watch the sermons, and if you have questions about fasting, you shoot a message to church. I'll be happy to talk to you. But fasting is probably the most important thing you're probably not doing as a Christian. Not because it makes God listen to you, because it makes you hear God. There's nothing more primal in man than eating. Yes, we need it to survive, right? We need to eat to survive. And if you get hungry, you start looking for food. And food you will eat when you're hungry, you would never touch, you know, when you're not hungry, because you're just that hungry. There's this drive in you. And fasting says, I'm going to take this drive for earthly food, and I'm going to set aside, I'm going to drive for heavenly food instead. That's what fasting says. And God says, when I have your attention like that, I can speak to you. I've fasted several times since we've done that series, and I'll just tell you, I've never felt a sense that God was on my prayers and I could just go around, you know, touching people and watching them heal or anything like that. But I will tell you that every time I fasted, God just starts speaking to me. Like little things I wasn't even thinking about. All of a sudden, you almost need to keep a journal, because I got to write that down fast before I forget it. It's been amazing how many times he's spoken to me there. And the weird thing for me is he usually does like in the first hour of my fast. I'm like, man, I could stop fasting now, but I never do. You know, I fall through to the end. But anyway, that's what happens. And I want to show you the life of Esther after the moment she fasts. That's when everything changes. This is her path after that. She fasts, she makes her decision. And what she makes her decision is, you know what? I'm putting all my chips in the middle. I'm all in, God. I'm all in. But see, I believe that when she fasted, God spoke to her. You know, from my experience, God speaks to us when we fast. And I believe he spoke to her and he says, Esther, I do want you to do this, and here's what's going to happen. You're going to have two meals, and then you're going to, and I just think he laid it all out for her. I think that from the moment she fasted, she came out of that room going, oh, this is going to be fun. Just wait. And everything happened exactly the way God said, because the way she puts this together was strictly God. And all the different, you know, details, the two, you know, cups of wine, the judgment, the sanctification, all these things she does perfectly. So after that, she outsmarts Haman. No small feat. Haman was a political animal. That's why he had gotten risen to where he was. He's very smart. He was very connected. She outsmarts him. She rewards Mordecai. She saves the Jews. She destroys her enemies. And then she establishes Thanksgiving for the Jews. Boy, this is important, because if we don't establish traditions of Thanksgiving, we'll forget. We do anyway. How many times have we completely forgotten what God's done for us? So she establishes that, and then she rules like no other Persian queen ever. This whole story starts off where Vashti is basically just a trophy queen, right? This beautiful woman, and he wants to show her off before all of his drunken buddies, right? And she says, no. Oh my God, gotta get rid of her. So if you showed any sense of you're gonna get uppity on the king, you're gone, right? Instead, Esther takes over. I mean, she like rules the kingdom. She'll rule for several years. She rules like no queen has ever ruled in Persia. Let me put this another way. She becomes what Vashti wanted to be, because she follows God's path. And then this last one, which I'm sure wasn't anything that she wanted, but this is just God for you. She's remembered forever. Let me ask you a question. Could you name for me three ancient queens? Because I'm betting you can name maybe three. If I said, hey, name an ancient queen, you may come up with Cleopatra. You know, Egypt, Cleopatra, maybe Jezebel. Well, she's more infamous than famous. Who else you got? Julius Caesar's, who, what? Somebody else gave him one? No? We got Julius Caesar's wife, don't know her name. The Queen of Sheba, I don't know her name. Augustus Caesar's wife, don't know her name. But Esther, Xerxes' wife, we know her name. And of all those, there's only one that still has a banquet being celebrated every year in her honor, and that's Esther. For 3,000 years, she was remembered forever. That wasn't her plan, but that's God for you. You want to make your life relevant, because I think we all do. I want to make my life relevant. Here's how you do. You push your chips in the middle and say, God, it's all you. See, everything changed for Esther the moment she decided she would rather be a princess of heaven than the queen of Persia. That's what she decided. If I die, I die. But I am not going to live as the queen of Persia and back down on my king in heaven. I'm not going to do that. I'm going to give it up. And so my question is, what's keeping you from that? Because there's always something that we're afraid we're going to lose. If I give this to God, I'm going to lose it. I don't want to lose it. And God's saying, if you just give it to me, you'll be amazed what I can do with it. And in fact, basically, your life just meanders. And if you're meandering through life, I'm telling you, there's a reason for that. You haven't chosen your king yet. And by the way, you kind of choose one by default. You either choose the king of heaven or you end up with, serving the king of this world. That's it. You don't get to choose none of the above. Nobody gets to choose none of the above. It's one or the other. And if you choose the king of heaven, then you need to make sure you can hear his voice. That's why fasting is so incredibly, incredibly important. In fact, my new thing now, if anybody comes to me, just warning you now, if you come to me and say, hey, I'm really having a hard time understanding something, I'm praying about, I'm not getting any answers, my first question you now will be, well, have you fasted? Because that's when God really speaks to us. Are you serious about wanting to hear what God has to say? Have you fasted? And I don't mean giving up Facebook for a week. That's not fasting. Go listen to the sermons. We talk about all that, right? Or give up sin for a week. I just won't go on internet porn for a month. I'm fasting. No, you're not. You're just not sinning for this month. That's not fasting, right? We got to get that right. But if you fasted, have you really honestly sought God through fasting? Because if you want him to answer and you haven't done that, then you haven't tried. Because the Bible's full of people fasting, including Jesus Christ himself. Are you fasting? And so that's how you hear the marching orders from your king. And Jesus told us this. He said, look, you can't serve two masters. You can't. You're going to pick one. He says, you're either going to hate one and love the other, or you're going to be devoted to one, despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon. Now, some Bibles translate that money. That's a bad translation. It was mammon. Mammon was literally a god that was worshipped at the time. It was a god of the world, who promised people wealth. That's how it gets confused with money. But he actually said, you can't worship the God of heaven and the God of the world. Esther, you cannot be the queen of Persia and a princess of heaven. You're going to have to choose. You have to choose. Whatever your job is, whatever you're doing, doesn't matter. What matters is where your heart is and what it's doing. Have you chosen me or not? And when she says, yes, I have, God says, wait till you see what we're going to do next. And he did all that with her life. In Joshua, the last thing Joshua says to the Israelites, he pulls them all out, and there's some confusion amongst them. They're not sure. They want to try to go for the promised land and all this. And he, in the last sermon that he preaches to the Israelites, he says, listen, look, if serving God, the Lord God who brought you out, is undesirable, then don't. Yeah, go ahead. Choose who you will serve. Who are you going to choose? The gods of Egypt? Okay. Or the gods of this land in which you're now dwelling? You go ahead. You choose that. But as for me and my house, we're going to serve the Lord. And that is still what's before you. If it's too hard being a Christian, then don't. If you don't want to serve Jesus Christ, then don't. But understand, if you're not choosing him, you're choosing the God of this world. But we have to tell ourselves, no, as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. The question is, who is your king? Would you please pray with me?